Debbie, but I didn't know all the parts of that story, so I really appreciate you being willing to share the hard parts. And as Ann said, I'm with you guys. I like the spotlights better than a lot of the other stuff. But one of the things I'm going to be talking about this morning is human approval, so I hope you do like what I'm going to say. Okay, so this year in our study of Acts, we've been learning about the early church and how it grew. So the church began in Jerusalem, and the first Christians were all Jews who heard the gospel message and believed. And what we read in the first part of Acts were a lot of stories about Peter and other apostles or early followers talking to other Jewish people about Jesus being their long-awaited Messiah, and also sharing the gospel message about how God's kingdom had come to earth and how they could have a relationship with God, have their sins be forgiven, not by perfectly following the law, but through faith in Christ. And then after Stephen died, many of these early believers fled the persecution that they were experiencing in Jerusalem, and they went to Judea and Samaria, where they continued to share the gospel message primarily with other Jewish people. So what this means is that before Peter realized that through faith in Christ, Gentiles were also called to be a part of God's family, and before Paul began his ministry to Gentiles in his missionary journeys, that most of the people who heard the gospel message and believed were primarily Jews who already knew and believed in Old Testament scriptures. So they came from the same similar kind of background. Or they were a few select Gentiles who are referred to in scriptures as God-fearers, which means that they too recognized that the Yahweh of Israel was the one true God. Last week when Anne was teaching about Paul's first sermon in chapter 13, we can see this. He was speaking to a crowd that he knew was made up of both Jews and a few Gentiles who had abandoned their pagan beliefs. And so that's why he addressed this crowd first as fellow Israelites and you Gentiles who worship God. And then later he calls them or addresses the crowd as fellow children of Abraham and you God-fearing Gentiles. But as the early church continued to grow, it moved out of the Jewish villages in Palestine into Greco-Roman cities throughout the empire, where it began to come into contact with very different kind of people. People who had been living in pagan, polytheistic cultures, and who had very different belief systems. So during Paul's missionary journeys to cities throughout the Mediterranean region, he begins sharing the gospel with these kinds of people who came from very different backgrounds and different belief systems than the Jews who were the earliest converts to Christianity. Here's a copy of the map that's in our study guide that shows Paul's first missionary journey, and it shows the various cities that he traveled to. Those places that you can see on the map where Paul was evangelizing could be called multicultural. They had many different groups of people that believed many different things. Some of the people that Paul was trying to reach in these places either knew nothing about the Old Testament scriptures, or they rejected them because they believed in pagan gods. So what we can learn from Paul about how to effectively share the gospel, how to share our faith in this kind of multicultural environment, is actually really relevant to us because we live in a very similar culture in which some of the people that we interact with and that we may get a chance to share our faith with either don't know much about the Bible, they may not believe it, or they just may believe something much different than we do. And as we look at today's passage, I think we're going to see that there's three key things about Paul's approach to sharing the gospel message with people who have very different belief systems that we can learn from and apply to our lives. So first, I'm going to summarize the three things and how they apply to us, and then I'll go into more depth about each one of them. So the first thing we see is just about how Paul shared the gospel. He ministered to people's physical needs as well as talking to them about their spiritual emptiness. And I think one reason people listened to what Paul had to say is because of the impact of what he did. Paul showed his love and he showed his concern for people's situations by what he did in addition to talking to them about God's love for them. The second thing we're going to see about how Paul shared the gospel is that he met people where they were. And what I mean by this is that Paul tailored his message to his audience. So in the verses that we're looking at today, when Paul is speaking to pagans, he never even mentions the Old Testament scriptures. He never even talks about the idea of sin. And that's usually exactly where he started when he was talking to Jewish audiences. And then the third thing that we're going to see about Paul sharing the gospel is that despite his best efforts, he often met with disapproval, he faced rejection and even persecution, but he persevered. He never gave up, and I think one reason is because Paul never took human approval into account, and he never let human disapproval or rejection or even persecution stop him. Although Paul cared deeply about people in terms of their eternal destiny, and although he really wanted fellow Jews to hear the gospel message and to believe, their approval wasn't his ultimate goal. That's not what drove him. In his letter to the Colossians, Paul tells us pretty clearly what drove him and who he was working to serve. He writes, "Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for men, since you know that you will receive an inheritance from the Lord as a reward. It is the Lord Christ you are serving." So again, Paul was pretty clear about whose approval he was seeking. And I think there's applications to our own lives from each of the three things that we see Paul demonstrating in today's passage. The first one is that we need to be living out the gospel with our actions as well as sharing it with our words. We need to show love and concern for people's situations by what we do and not just talk to them about what we believe. And in order to engage effectively with people who have very different belief systems than we do, I think we need to be careful to share the truth, but do it with grace and with love and in a way that shows respect for other people. And then third, we need to be thinking about what's driving us. While it's human nature, especially for women, to want people to like us and to have their approval, we need to always remember that ultimately human approval and human accolades aren't what's most important. One of the questions in the study guide really hit on this issue when it asked us to consider whether our need for human approval hinders our passion for Jesus. I think that'd be a great thing for us to talk about in our small groups. Another aspect of being too concerned with human approval is that we need to realize that we will face rejection when we try to share our faith. But just like Paul, we need to not get discouraged and give up. We need to keep in mind that it's really only God's approval that matters, not human approval. And here's why it's worth it for us to face even a little rejection, because we could make a difference in just where one person spends eternity. So let's go back now to the verses that we studied for today and look a little more closely at each of these three things that we see Paul doing. So one of the first things we should notice is that Paul didn't just talk about what he believed. He really lived out his beliefs. He showed God's love to other people through his actions. In the verses we're looking at today, he healed the lame man. Now, admittedly, we're probably not going to be able to work a miracle like this, but we can still show love to somebody in need so that just like Paul, we're ministering to them by what we do as well as by what we say. And what we might find is that people are often a whole lot more willing to listen to what we have to say after we've already showed them by our actions that we really care about them. And when we look at scriptures, it's pretty clear that loving the poor and the needy through actions is often coupled with sharing the gospel message. Jesus often combined his teaching with healing the sick and raising the dead. In the first part of Acts, we read how Peter often healed people while he was preaching. And in chapter 8 of Acts, we read about how Philip was healing and casting out demons while he was sharing the gospel in Samaria. So you might be thinking to yourself, that sounds great, but I'm probably not going to be able to heal people or do other miraculous things. But we should remember that in the early church, showing love and compassion to other people wasn't done only through miracles. Philip and Stephen were both part of a group of men in the early church who were specifically given the responsibility of ministering to people, of doing things to take care of them. In chapter 6, we're specifically told that they took on tasks such as feeding widows in order to take care of that vulnerable group of people. In today's passage, we see Paul doing the same thing. He's showing love to a needy person. He's caring for the lame man's physical well-being as well as for his soul. And in doing that, Paul was embodying the gospel message. He was pouring himself out for the needs of others. And his actions probably gave greater credibility to his words. Now, Paul may also have used the healing of this man as a way to reach the people in the town of Lystra, where today's passage is set. And it certainly worked. He got their attention by this miraculous healing. But because of their pagan background, they completely misunderstood what had happened. And they thought that this miracle meant that Paul and Barnabas must be two of their pagan Greek gods. They thought they were Zeus and Hermes come down to earth. And that's why they wanted to offer sacrifices to them. So this somewhat strange reaction is based on their local folklore. These people believe that in the past, Zeus and Hermes had come down to their town of Lystra in disguise and asked for food and lodging, and that everybody except for one couple turned them away. Well, the gods then took revenge on the town, and they drowned everyone in it except for that one couple whose home was then turned into a temple. So these pagan people didn't want to make the same mistake twice, right, of not recognizing when their gods were among them. And that's why they, along with their temple priest, wanted to offer sacrifices to Paul and Barnabas after they saw this miraculous healing. So this town where the events took place, Lystra, was located in a Roman province in what is today present-day Turkey. It was a place where Greeks controlled the commerce and where there were so few Jews there wasn't even a synagogue. It was populated primarily with these uneducated Lycaonian people who spoke their own language and worshipped pagan gods. So because of their very confused reaction to his healing of the lame man, Paul realizes that he's talking to uneducated people who believe in pagan gods. Now, it was interesting, I thought, to note that Paul didn't ever try to capitalize on their initial, what you could call approval, when they thought he was a god. And he didn't even use that to try to keep himself physically safe. Instead, we read that Paul and Barnabas were appalled and that Paul immediately tried to set these people straight and to continue to convince them of the truth of the gospel. And he did it by using something in their own belief system, just like he did with Jewish audiences. To Jews, Paul always used their own history and their own holy scriptures to prove to them how they could never fully obey the law and be truly righteous as a way to God, and that Jesus was the fulfillment of their Old Testament messianic hopes. Here's an example of Paul doing this later in Acts when he's speaking to leaders of Roman synagogues. He was solemnly testifying to them about the kingdom of God and trying to persuade them concerning Jesus from both the law of Moses and from the prophets, from morning until evening. So you can see from these verses that Paul uses something from the Jews' own belief system to try to convince them that Jesus is their long-awaited Messiah, and that through him their sin can be forgiven. So the Jews were trying to please God by perfectly following his laws, something they could never do. These pagan people were making a different mistake. They were worshiping false gods. But this is why Paul takes a very different approach with them. He never even mentions the Old Testament scriptures. He never talks about the idea of sin, because these people didn't know the Old Testament scriptures and they didn't believe in the idea of sin. And so neither of those would have been compelling arguments to them. So instead, Paul takes a totally different tact to try to reach people who lived in a culture with many gods and where each individual often worshipped and sacrificed to the particular god that they thought could help them. So knowing that he's in this kind of culture, Paul relies on a theological concept that's called general revelation as a means of persuading these pagan people that there is one true sovereign God. So this is the second thing we should see about how Paul shares the gospel in this passage and that we're going to be able to apply. He tailors his message to his audience. He always speaks the truth. That never changes, but he emphasizes different things depending upon what he thinks is going to be meaningful to the people that he's trying to reach. So here in Lystra, when he's preaching to pagans who didn't know the Old Testament scriptures and who didn't believe in the idea of sin, Paul talks to them about God as the creator of all life. He uses this idea of general revelation, which is that creation itself provides evidence of God's existence. It's the idea that people anywhere can look at images like this in the world around them, and they can see evidence of God's sovereign power, of his character, and of his divine nature in the earth that he created and that he continues to sustain. In Psalm 19, we see the psalmist saying this same thing about God's creation providing evidence of his existence, where the psalmist writes that the heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they display knowledge. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Their voice goes out into all the earth and their words to the ends of the world. So in the passage that we're looking at today, we see Paul trying to find a way to speak truth that would make sense to his pagan audience and possibly allow him to get through to them. And that's why he tells these people in verse 15 that God made all three realms of the Greek cosmos, the heaven, the earth, and the sea. And he reminds them in verse 17 that it's God who has brought rains from heaven, crops in their season, and an abundance of food for them. So in doing this, Paul's pointing out to them that every good thing in life is from God. So here again, just like he does when he's preaching to Jews, Paul takes something from their own belief system. In this case, it's the Greek cosmos, in order to help prove the existence of one true God who is sovereign over everything. Later on, when Paul writes his letter to the Romans, we can see that once again he uses this same idea of general revelation. In that letter, he writes that since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power, and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, meaning creation, so that they, men, are without excuse. So what we can see in our passage so far are three things. First, Paul crafted what he said to be an effective outreach to each particular audience that he was trying to talk to, whether they were pagan or Jewish. But also, Paul used his actions as well as his words to demonstrate his love for the people he was trying to reach. He showed love and compassion by what he did as well as by what he said. And then finally, Paul wasn't driven by human approval, and he didn't fear disapproval or even rejection or persecution. And the reason is because Paul was only interested in Jesus. So now let's talk about how this passage applies to us. As I mentioned before, there are actually a lot of similarities between the culture where Paul was operating in the first century Roman Empire and our culture today. There are many different religious faith communities in our country today, as well as a lot of people who don't believe in any higher power. And on top of that, we live in a culture that's becoming increasingly hostile to our Christian worldview, and they see us as intolerant. So what can we learn from today's passage in order to do a better job of reaching out to people with very different belief systems in the culture we live in? I think there are some really good applications for our lives about how to do a better job of engaging the world around us when we're trying to share our faith, particularly with people who may have very different belief systems than we do, as well as the importance of showing love to people around us with our actions. And another really important takeaway from today's passage is that we shouldn't let human approval motivate us or the lack of it discourage us. So the first important thing we can take away from today's verses is that we're not supposed to just talk about our faith. We're meant to embody our beliefs by what we do. If we want to emulate Paul and Jesus, we'll eventually find ourselves hanging out with or interacting with people who are very different than we are and who may really disagree with what we believe in. Of course, those are the very people who most need to hear the gospel message. And our response to people like this who may have very different beliefs or lifestyles, or who may even be hostile to our beliefs, shouldn't be to just tolerate them, but to actually love them through our actions. Most of you are probably familiar with the well-known parable that Jesus told about the Good Samaritan. That guy was willing to help somebody in need. In his case, he rescued and cared for a Jewish man that he came across who was laying on the side of the road after he had been robbed and beaten and probably left for dead. The Samaritan was willing to show love to that Jewish man, even though he knew that in the first century, Jews despised Samaritans. Well, the moral of that story for us is that we need to be more like the Good Samaritan. We need to be willing to show love through our actions, even to people who may despise us, or people whose lifestyles we don't approve of, or people whose beliefs we know are wrong. And we need to do this not only because we're called to, but because this can be a very effective witness to the world around us. We should try to show love to other people even while we really disagree with their beliefs or their lifestyles. I think a great example of this, of reaching out in love, is the Save the Stork ministry that was introduced to Grace a couple of months ago. This ministry brings mobile buses with ultrasound machines outside of abortion clinics, and it also provides follow-up assistance as a way of trying to get women to consider another choice. By doing this, the people in that ministry, they're reaching out and showing love to people in need, the people whose actions they don't agree with. And when the guy who heads this ministry up was telling us about it at Grace a couple of months ago, he went on to say that at a different presentation that he made, a young lady came up to him afterwards and she told him she really wished his ministry had been around for her. And she went on to tell him that the only Christians she encountered outside the abortion clinic she had gone to years before were throwing garbage at her. Now, I'm sure those people were trying to uphold their belief in the sanctity of human life. But I don't think they did a very good job of reaching out and showing love to a needy person. I don't think they modeled what Jesus probably would have done in that situation. The application for us is that we need to ask ourselves if what we do usually reflects what we say we believe. Because our goal should be to live in a way that blends our beliefs with what we do. We know that we've been shown grace and love by God when we didn't deserve it, and we need to show that same grace and love to other people through our actions as well as our words. And showing love to other people by what we do can often be a much more compelling way of sharing our faith and sharing the gospel than anything we could say. You know that well-known saying, actions speak louder than words? Well, I think it's really true. Nothing speaks more powerfully than loving on other people, especially if you don't agree with their beliefs or their lifestyles. I think St. Francis captured this idea of the importance of our actions perfectly when he said, always share the gospel message, and when necessary, use words. A second important takeaway for us from today's passage is about how we talk to other people about our faith, especially people who may have very different beliefs than we do. And I think a really important thing to keep in mind is that we shouldn't go into those kinds of conversations like they're a debate that we need to win by talking more or louder or insisting that we're right. Instead, we need to make sure that our underlying attitude shows grace and respect for the other person, no matter how much we might oppose their beliefs. We don't have to agree on anything, and we don't have to soften our own convictions in order to be respectful to another person. And we may find that reaching out with respect ultimately helps our voices to be heard better. And there are other verses in Scripture that address this idea of showing respect to other people. In 1 Peter, we learn to always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have, but do this with gentleness and respect. And in Colossians, Paul teaches to conduct yourselves with wisdom toward outsiders, making the most of the opportunity. Let your speech always be with grace, as though seasoned with salt, so that you will know how you should respond to each person. We now live in a very diverse and very pluralistic culture in which there are profound differences in worldviews and religious beliefs, and in which the divides between people seem to be getting wider. If any of you have had a conversation recently with somebody about a really tough topic and they have an opposing view, say something like gay marriage or nowadays just whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, you might have felt like the differences between your two viewpoints were so wide and so huge that it almost felt like the other person was speaking a foreign language. And when you're facing differences this profound, it might make you feel like there is no way I can effectively talk to this person about what I believe because I'm over here and they are way over there. But I think it is possible. But to do this, to share our faith effectively, besides having an underlying attitude of respect, we may need to change our approach when we're trying to reach people who have very different belief systems, just like Paul did in the passage that we're looking at today. So for us, instead of jumping right in and telling somebody what we believe, oftentimes, especially if you're talking to somebody who has a very different belief system, it's actually much more effective to start out by finding out what they believe and why. I recently read a couple books that both had some really good ideas about how to share our faith in a respectful way with people who may have very different belief systems than we do. One book is titled Good Faith, and the other is called A New Kind of Apologist. An apologist is somebody who makes a defense of an idea either in talking or in writing. So a Christian apologist would be somebody who's defending their faith. So both of these books make the case that our goal shouldn't be to immediately prove that we're right when we're talking to somebody who has very different beliefs than we do, but instead to take a much more long-term approach and to engage with people in a way that blends grace and love with the truth that we're trying to share. And it can result in a respectful dialogue, which will hopefully, eventually, result in a chance for us to share our faith in an effective way. So in order to begin a good dialogue with somebody who may have very different religious beliefs, Sean McDowell, who's the author of A New Kind of Apologist, came up with four questions we should ask. And as a starting point, he emphasizes that we need to really be willing to practice true tolerance for the other person. Now, being tolerant doesn't mean that we have to acquiesce to their beliefs or agree that they're right. We can hang on to our beliefs and still be tolerant in our demeanor and in our approach. In this scenario, what being truly tolerant for another person means is to be willing to really listen to what they have to say in a respectful manner. And not only might this allow you to gain their trust, but it's much more likely to keep their mind open to you when you have a chance to share your beliefs. Because the bottom line is if we want other people to listen to our story and our convictions, we have to be willing to listen to theirs. And that's what these four questions are designed to do. They're designed to draw somebody out about what they believe and why. So here are the questions. A first really good question to ask somebody with very different beliefs is, what do you believe? Because before you respond to somebody, it's pretty important to find out what they believe by asking them and then by really listening to what they have to say. And oftentimes, this is exactly the opposite of what we do, right? We're so eager to tell other people what we believe that we forget to ask them what they believe. And again, when we're trying to find out what someone else believes, we need to make sure that the other person feels heard and respected. We need to temporarily set aside our objections to what they're saying and let them talk without being challenged. And then, after really listening, we need to dig a little bit deeper, and we can do this by asking the next question. Find out why they believe what they do. A lot of times, if you've ever talked with somebody who has a big difference of opinion with you, you just trade conclusions. You say what you believe, they say what they believe, and nobody ever talks about how you arrived at your conclusions. So the second step when you're trying to really respectfully engage with somebody is to find out why they believe the things they do. And we'll often find that just like us, their convictions are deeply entwined with their personal history. things like their family, their life experiences, or maybe some particular people along the way that really influenced them. So our goal should be to find out what their beliefs are based on by asking questions like, how did you come to believe that? Or what influenced your thinking on that? There's a great example of this kind of approach in another really interesting book that I read that's called Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus. That book tells the amazing true story of how a young American Muslim who came from a very devout family eventually became a Christian. And that young guy's conversion was based on years of conversations, years of dialogue with his best friend from college. That friend was a really strong Christian who knew his own theology well enough to defend it and to disprove the false things that his Muslim friend had been taught about Christianity. And that young guy also knew enough about Islam to ask the right questions about what his Muslim friend's beliefs were based on. Over time, and because the young Christian apologist was willing to really listen and really probe the basis of his friend's faith in Islam, he was able to convince him that Jesus is God and that Christianity is right and true. So back to our questions. A third really good question is designed to find out, where do we agree? After you've put in the effort to really try to understand the other person's position, then try to cultivate some common ground. Try to see if there's any place that their worldview overlaps our Christian worldview. So, for example, if you're in the middle of a dialogue or a conversation with a Mormon, and they start talking to you about the importance of family, that's something that you could point to and affirm as a piece of God's truth that's buried in their wider belief system. Now, the fourth question is open-ended because it's based on figuring out with this particular person that I'm talking to in this particular situation, what should I ask now? So again, you're not trying to mount a full defense of your position because it's not about scoring points. It's not about winning an argument. It's about continuing to have a respectful conversation. So at this point, you should have one communication goal with your fourth question. Could be to gather more information or clarify something that the person said that you're not clear about. Could be to cultivate more common ground, or maybe to respectfully rebut one point they made that you want to show is incorrect. Or maybe it's just to try and find time for the next conversation. Again, the goal is to continue to engage in a respectful manner. It's not to win a war of words in one conversation. That's exactly what the young guy in Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus did. One at a time, he identified an idea about Christianity that was a stumbling block for his Muslim friend. For example, the idea that Jesus really did die on the cross. And then this young guy would find the historical facts to back up his belief. And what happened was over a long period of time, he chipped away one at a time at all the incorrect beliefs that his friend had about Christianity and about his own Muslim faith. So now we've covered what might be a better approach to engaging people when sharing our faith in this very diverse, pluralistic world that we live in, and how we should also be living out our beliefs, because our actions will often speak to people much more profoundly than anything we could say. So that leaves us with the third key thing that we can learn from Paul in today's passage, which is not to be driven by the desire for human approval or accolades. We always need to remember whose approval we should really be seeking, and that, of course, is God's. And we also need to keep in mind that even when we do our best to speak the truth, even with respect to other people, we're going to meet with rejection. We're probably eventually going to meet with persecution. But we shouldn't let that stop us from continuing to try to share our faith. We're seeing in our study of Acts just how much rejection and persecution Paul faced throughout his life. But every time, he just picked himself up and kept on going. Paul came to Lystra, where today's passage was set, after he was run out of a nearby town called Iconium. And the verses that we studied today that Anne read for us this morning ended with Paul being stoned and left for dead after some Jews from Iconium came to Lystra to stir the people there up against Paul. And in the last verse that we've studied for today, we see what Paul's response was. He got up and he went back into the city. So the application of that for us is that we need to know that we're going to face rejection when we try to share our faith. And we need to be okay with that. As Christians, we should look really different from other people in the way that we deal with rejection. We should have a certain acceptance, even grace, and even joy in the face of rejection and other hardships that isn't the norm in today's culture. And the reason is because when we experience rejection or suffering for the sake of Jesus, it's one way we can become more like him, and it's another way we can live out our faith. So I want to close this morning with what the authors of Good Faith have to say about being rejected when we try to share our faith. If we faithfully live the countercultural life that Jesus calls us to, we'll endure uncomfortable situations, lose a few arguments, be embarrassed when we're backed into a corner. Doesn't sound so good so far, does it? It's kind of the opposite of getting human approval. But here's why, just like Paul, we should never give up, because this is what the authors go on to write. And always, in everything, we will love. We've been given a glimpse into the future, which can and should shape our imaginations as we partner with God in his work to renew all things. We can walk forward with hope and joy because we know the good ending to the story we're living in. Let's close together in prayer. Heavenly Father, I thank you for Paul. I thank you for his teaching. And I thank you for this passage today and what we can learn from Paul. And I hope that we can take to heart some of the lessons that he demonstrated in this passage, that we need to show love to other people as well as talk about it. And we need to be equipped. We need to be ready to engage people who may have very different beliefs than we do in the culture that we live in, and that we need to not depend on human approval. We need to only be looking for your approval. So I ask that you give us the strength and the wisdom to be able to do these things. And I ask these things in your son's name. Amen.